My name's James and I'm an addict. Also, thanks to Tash as well for asking me to speak tonight. Thanks everyone that does service at this meeting. Thank you, Shireen. Thank you, Hugo. Thank you, Bex. Thank you everyone involved, because this meeting, all of these meetings, will save lives. We've all spoken to people that wouldn't be around now if it wasn't for NA meetings, but specifically this one. It's been tough keeping everything going, so thank you for your service. A couple of weeks ago, a friend of mine said that I'd inspired her to work the steps, and I was completely blown away by that because there's nothing, I don't think there's anything inspirational about me. And I thought, like, you what? And she said, well, if the 12 steps can work for you, James, they can work for anyone. And it took me a while to sort of unpick that and see what she meant. And a few years, I think it's because a few years ago, I was just incredibly cynical, incredibly arrogant. I wouldn't share my feelings. I wouldn't tell anyone when something was going wrong. And most importantly, I just couldn't live life on life's terms. My sort of childhood experiences kind of set me up for that. And I'm not saying this because I'm trying to position myself into victimhood here, but I think it's important to just establish stuff that went on. I was bullied a lot as a child. When I was at school for a couple of years, my nickname was Fat Shit. And it was scary going to school every day. And stuff was difficult for me at home as well. My dad had just died when I was quite young, and mum had started to have her own problems with mental health and drugs as well. And at that sort of age, I learned how to escape. And like a lot of us, the first few things I'd use to escape would be food, or books or TV. And like Karis was talking about just now, shoplifting as well was a big thing for me. One of my earliest memories, I think I was, well, I was about, well, not that early, I was about six or seven. I remember finding a little nook in the co-op that was between two shelves that I could just about hide in and slip between. And I'd hide in this little bit of the co-op and I'd steal sweets from the shelf and just eat them in the corner and think that they hadn't seen me. And all of this because I was sort of learning at such an early age that I could and should use things to cover up my emotions, to cover up feelings that I'm either unwilling or unable to process. And that sort of developed as I sort of grew up. I say grew up, I didn't really grow up. Things just got bigger and badder. Alcohol started in my mid-teens, and my first blackout felt like a badge of honor. It was brilliant because I'd been out and I'd been with my mates, and I had a whole period when I wasn't responsible for what I was doing because that was part of my fear, this sort of crushing responsibility for everything I've done being my fault, everything around me being my fault. It's all part of this horrible spiraling self-obsession. And an alcohol being a drug then turned into other drugs. And for a while, like a lot of us have experienced, it was fun. And then after a while, it wasn't fun, it was necessary. I had to be using in order to just block things out so I wasn't suffering from this horrible self-obsession all of the time. And then it wasn't just necessary, it was everything. Drugs was everything. And it all became more extreme as well as I got more and more trapped in it. My addiction to food was getting worse. Sex was getting worse as well. That was another thing I discovered could cover up the way I felt. And drink and drugs kind of went hand in hand. And at the time, I didn't realize they were the same thing. So I thought I could swap around and it would be all right. So if I use too much of this or too much of that, I'll go back to booze for a while. Or if I drank too much, I was getting a little bit too fat. Oh, I'll go back to drugs because they're a bit slimming. That's all right. See, I didn't think I was being insane. I thought I was actually being cunning. Of course, I wasn't. I was, how do people put it? I was swapping deck chairs on the Titanic, really. And it was just the insanity of it. The first time I OD'd, it was when I'd invited somebody around for sex, and I just passed out in front of him, and he called an ambulance for me. And I came to in hospital, and he sent me a text message saying, "You seem like a nice person. I hope you don't die. P.S. I fed your cat for you." And I can look back on it and laugh at the insanity right now. And that scared me off using for about 48 hours. And then I was back in it again because I was powerless. Of course, at the time, I didn't know what powerlessness was. And that powerlessness and insanity, it got bigger and badder. There were psychoses. There were times I was running up and down my flat, leaving footprints in blood because I was running around on broken glass. I'll try and keep the war stories to a minimum, but I think sometimes it's important to get it out there because we identify through this, and we also identify through the hope. And in the middle of all of this, the sex addiction was getting worse as well. I went out one night and went out looking for sex and got blackout drunk. I was actually, at the time, I'd managed to put down drugs for a little while, like I had done for a few times. I got a few weeks, maybe a couple of months of abstinence, went back to square one again. But I went out this night with booze, got blackout drunk, and I don't know what happened next, but I do know that I came home from that night with HIV. And you would have thought that would have stopped me. I would have thought that would have stopped me, but no. That made it even worse, because then I kind of felt, well, in for a penny, I might as well completely fuck everything up now. Excuse my swearing. But somehow in the middle of all of this, I managed to hold down a job, and I was living an almost complete double life. Nobody knew all of this was going on. And it reached a point when I was using 24/7, the particular drug that really brought me to my knees, I reached a point when I needed to take it every 3 or 4 hours, day or night, or I'd go into seizures with withdrawal. And somehow, like I said, I managed to hide everything through all of this as well. No one knew this was going on. And at work, I'd somehow managed to get myself into a position of responsibility, but I was a chronic people pleaser, and I would do whatever was necessary to make you accept me or to make you like me. And one of the things I was asked to do at work was to get rid of someone, to manage them out. And I thought it was a bit dubious, but I did it anyway because I wanted my boss to like me. And a couple of months after the guy was sacked, he died of a heart attack. And it just, to have been part of that, it just shattered me. And things started spiraling even more out of control at that point. And the shit kind of hit the fan one day. I OD'd at work and I passed out and got taken away by ambulance and was... And as I left hospital again, I was so mortified because everyone knew what happened now. I was so mortified, I started using again on the way home from the hospital. Guess what happened? I OD'd again. And I got taken back to the same hospital, saw the same people. And they were non-pleased. I left a second time. And I'm still racked in self-consciousness and self-obsession and shame. I used again, I OD'd again, I got taken back to hospital for the third time. At this point, life was unmanageable. When I finally got home, I was not well. Friends at this point knew that I was fucked, and they tried to help me out, but I wasn't listening, because it was people outside saying, "Oh, you should do this, or you should do that." And I called NA. And I remember talking to a guy that said, "There's a meeting down the road from you." This was the first bit of hope that I had. He said, "There's a meeting down the road. The most intimidating thing that might happen there is somebody might offer you a cup of tea." So I went to this first meeting. I was still using. And I remember being told the 12th step was a bit gaudy. And so I thought, let's take that, let's see how it goes. And I walked into this church hall, and there were people playing a guitar. And I thought, that's not what I'm expecting. They carried on playing their guitar. They're playing sort of Jesus-y, gaudy music. And it was only after I'd sat there for about 5 minutes until one of them, slightly embarrassed, points out that I'm in the wrong room. And actually, the NA meeting's next door. So I went through, and I remember seeing there was a woman sat there, and she was saying that she'd been clean for 20 years. And I could not get that. I could not understand that. She was saying, A, she's been clean for 20 years. It's possible through NA to be clean for 20 years, for life. But at the same time, does this mean you've got to keep coming back? And the meeting itself was, I think it was a step meeting. It was talking about step 10. I had no idea what it was. And I asked them, what are the steps? Tell me. And there was a guy there at the end, gave me a hug. He set me up to my next meeting. And he said, the only step you need to remember right now, step one, you are powerless. And I thought, yeah, okay, right. I'm going to text my friends and I tell them I'm powerless. That's step one, done, tick. Because I didn't understand it. I had no idea at all. And I went to my second meeting, which was Trafalgar Square. And I sat there crying, still using, still with my drugs in my bag, because that little announcement we have in the meeting saying, if you've got something, stash it outside, that didn't apply to me because obviously I'm special and different. So I'm sat there with my drugs hidden somewhere and listened to these messages of hope. And I remember the first meeting, I could actually hear it again because of the website that this meeting's got. And I played it back the other day. And the speaker starts by saying, if you're here, if you're at your first meeting, if you don't know what's going on, if you don't know what's happening, then welcome. You are in the right place. And that is the message that I needed to hear. And that is the message that we all needed to hear. If you're here right now and you can hear someone sharing and you've got something to share yourself, you're in the right place. This is going to save your life. And I sort of daisy chained through a couple of meetings. Somebody give me a number for another one. Somebody give me a time for another meeting. And I got a call from a friend of a friend in the rooms who had been using the same sort of drugs as me. And we had a really, really frank conversation on the phone. And he said, if you don't put yourself in somewhere with this particular drug, you're probably not going to get off it. So I took his advice. For the first time, I took somebody else's suggestion. And I went to a treatment center, and I remember there, again, I struggled with this idea of powerlessness because they were telling me I was powerless, or they're telling me that I should say that I'm powerless, but I didn't understand it because I'm thinking, well, I've done something about it now. I'm at a detox, so I'm not powerless because I'm doing something about it. And one of the counselors there even said, oh, but do you not think when you leave, one day you might fancy a pint? I'm like, nah, not me, definitely not. I think in the back of my head, he doesn't know, actually, I prefer wine. So I finished with this detox, and I managed to put down the drug that really, really had me by the throat. And I got home, and on the way home, I found myself arriving back in my flat with two bottles of wine in one hand and a packet of benzos in the other hand. And I remember sitting there looking. And for the first time, it started to make sense. I'm completely powerless. After all of this, I've gone straight back to the same position. And in that moment, I've realized that I've got a choice at this point. I've got this choice now. And if I don't make the right choice now, I might not be able to be in a position to make any more choices. And so I started going to meetings every day, more than once a day. I was doing it. In 1990, I got a sponsor, someone that I'd heard him talking about. I'd heard him sharing in meetings. He was saying stuff I could connect with. We seemed to have a lot in common. I thought he wouldn't be too shocked by my step four stuff. So I asked him to sponsor me. And that was the beginning of having somebody that I felt that I could trust in NA, and someone that had faith in me. And he asked me to do something that sometimes it's a bit controversial. He said, start working step one once you've finished your 90 and 90. Give it a bit of time to get your head together a little bit first. And I'm really glad that he did that. because it was only through that that I started to understand exactly what powerlessness meant. Because once I put the drugs down, I started to see the tentacles of addiction in every other part of my life. The sex was still there. Food was still there. Netflix, I think Kara's talking about Netflix just now. Compulsive buying things, waking up at 1 o'clock at 1 o'clock at night to go to the loo, instead of going to the loo, or sitting on the loo looking at eBay on my phone for hours, looking for ridiculous things like pillowcases. I was powerless in it. I was powerless, and I didn't. It took me a while to actually realize that. And once I realized I was powerless, I realized that what I needed next was hope. And I needed a higher power in my life. And I struggled with this idea of a higher power. I really did. I grew up Catholic, and it sort of it popped into my head thinking about this with the Today's Just for Today, which is about everybody having a God of their own understanding. And when I grew up, the idea of God was this bearded man on a cloud somewhere, this moral CCTV camera that took care of your grandparents and knew if you were masturbating. And I didn't agree with that. I didn't believe in that sort of God anymore. So the thought of even using that word just was tough. And saying the step three prayer, take my will and my life, sounded really dramatic to me. So instead I started to say it slightly differently. I started to say, take my will and my life into your care. Because this is what it's about. A higher power is something that cares for us. It wants us to do well. It wants us to survive and to thrive. But it was still difficult coming to a belief of what we actually mean by take my will in my life. And a couple of times when I've had steps that I've struggled to get, I've taken myself out of London. I've taken myself out of the country. And this time I went away to another country and went on a sort of walk. It was a long walk, so like a 500 mile walk, walking every day for a few weeks. And there are signposts that take you through this country. I've got a map as well. And for the first 2 weeks, I was clutching this map with white knuckles so hard because I didn't want to get lost. Every 20 minutes, I'm checking I'm in the right place. And then after 2 weeks, I realized there are signs up everywhere. The signs drawn on the floor. There are signs on trees that I walk past. There are road signs everywhere. And for me, this was the moment that the penny dropped about handing it over, about a higher power, about step three. Because I can either try and control everything myself and have a really, really stressful time and pour all of my energy in trying to control things, or I can just follow the signs. And for me, in that moment, everything lined up and everything started to make sense. And in that moment, I felt a connection to a God that I've never felt before. And I fell to my knees and I wept, I cried. I'd never felt that sort of feeling before, that peace and serenity, knowing that if I know that I've done the right thing, if I've done the right actions, the outcome itself, as long as I'm following the signs, that's all that matters. As long as I'm doing what I should be doing, that's all that matters. And God will take care of the rest. I'd never had that sort of feeling before. And working the steps has helped transform me from that position, really. Step four was hard. It wasn't as painful as I thought it was going to be. But all those things that we live with that sit in the back of our minds, with step four, you've got to take each and every one of them down, dust them off, arrange them in front of you and try and describe them. And that's exhausting work. But it's worthwhile. It is so worthwhile, because through that I started to see the patterns. I started to see the patterns in my relationships. I'd have the same relationship every single time. Every dozen or so times I've had a failed relationship, it's been the same one. Because I'll go into a relationship, I'll try and be the person you want me to be. I'll forget about myself. I'll become resentful. I'll then start messing around. It will then become too painful. Everything breaks down. And I hadn't realized that I'd done the same thing again and again and again. And I hadn't realized until I worked a step four how fearful I was. Well, I hadn't been able to call it fear. Even the silliest things. Sometimes it feels, this is current stuff really, sometimes it feels as though all of you guys have got the script. you know what you're supposed to say, you know what's going on, but I've turned up, but I've not read the script. I'm not sure what my lines are. I don't know what I'm supposed to say. Even with silly things, I got a membership card to a swimming pool, but because I didn't know exactly what words to use when I went in to use the pool, now, do I say I would like to swim? Do I say could I use a swimming pool? Because of that, I waited 6 months before I even used it, because I didn't know what to say, because of the self-obsession, because of this crushing self-consciousness all of the time. And through step four and through step five as well, I got to realize these things and externalize them for the first time ever. And Karis was talking about levels of truth, and oh gosh, okay, I need to speed up. Then I acknowledged Karis was talking about different levels of truth. With step five and with step four, it's, I've heard it described, think of a chest of drawers with three drawers, the top drawer stuff. That's the kind of things that you'll talk about with your mates, with your partner. The second drawer, a little bit deeper, that's the kind of things that you'd share with a therapist. But that bottom drawer, the things that wild horses couldn't drag out of you, that's the important stuff. That's what you need to be sharing with your sponsor. That's what should be in your step five. And I actually found steps six and seven to be even more painful, painful. I didn't expect them to be, because to work them, I had to live in my defects and shortcomings. I had to acknowledge that I'm a people pleaser. I had to acknowledge that I cover up emotions I don't want to feel. I had to acknowledge the things about food, things about sex. And then I had to look at it. And everywhere I looked, I'm in my defects for the whole time I'm writing step six and seven. And it was really painful. And again, I found myself at one of those positions at a crossroads. And I cried again, because I could see so clearly that my defects, my shortcomings, if I continue to act on them inch by inch, that's going to lead me right back down the same path to my addiction. And that terrified me. I never want that to happen again. I never want to go back to that madness again. And I've prayed every day since then. And I've learned now what powerlessness means. And I've learned what surrender means. I used to think, the term surrender didn't make sense to me, because the whole idea is we're fighting our addiction right now. And if I surrender, surely I'm giving up. No, surrender is when we give up to those feelings that we are trying not to experience. We surrender to that. We give up that fight, and then we don't need to use. That's what I learned. And so, yes, since then, I've prayed every day. I pray every morning to reflect. I pray, God, please help me to reflect so I can see myself, so I know what I'm doing. I pray to accept. I pray to accept myself so I can love myself. And I pray every day, every morning, for my defects to be lifted, so I can be the me that my higher power intends. And it's not easy on a day-to-day basis. I still find myself dwelling on the past quite a lot. And I speak to my sponsor about things like that. And he said, James, you need to pray for willingness to let go of the past. And I also pray every morning to be a vehicle of my higher power's love and compassion, because there have been times when things get really tough, and they do in recovery. It's not all easy. It's not all plain sailing. There are tough days. When things are tough for me, I fall back to just praying to be able to express love and compassion. And through that, I draw strength. Because I know when I'm expressing love and compassion for other people, that's the purest, most good thing that I can do. And whatever the outcome is, whatever the result is, it's going to be all right. And when we introduce at this meeting, when we introduce people, in fact, when we talk about our recovery, we use the term experience, strength, and hope. For me, it's been the other way around. There's the experience, there's the war stories, but then next for me came the hope. It was just the realization that something could be different, and it was possible, and through that, the strength then started to come. And just to finish up, just making it a little bit more current. It's been a bumpy week this week. Somehow, miraculously, I'm still employed, and work hasn't been easy. There have been some really tough times. Some things have happened that haven't gone my way, which I think isn't a very helpful way to be thinking about things to start with. But there have been some difficult moments this week, and I've had some moments when I felt fearful, and the fear has sort of crept in slowly, and it's been this familiar sort of fear. And I realized what it was, and I called it out. It was the same fear as what I was using. It's the fear of discovery. It's the fear of everything going wrong. And so I had to take a look at myself and just think, well, what have I really got to be afraid of? What am I doing that's wrong? And you know what? In the morning, I woke up. I didn't want to get out of bed, but I did. And I reached out. I grabbed my phone. I read the Just for Today. I've read some other meditations. I didn't want to pray. I wasn't in the mood for praying, but I did. I didn't want to go to a meeting, but I did. I felt awkward calling my sponsor about it, but I did. I didn't want to do step work, but I did it anyway. There's a pattern here. If I'm doing all these things, even when I'm feeling low, even when things are a bit shit, a bit tough, then I can't be going that far wrong. And everything works out as long as we are making sure we're making those right decisions ourselves. So to finish up, I came to NA purely because I wanted to stop using drugs 24 hours a day. And well, in NA, there's good news and there's bad news, isn't there? So the good news is you discover you can live without drugs. The bad news is you find out drugs aren't the problem. And there's a solution, though. And the solution is this program. The solution is the steps. The solution is coming to meetings and sharing openly and honestly about it. The solution is getting a sponsor you can talk to about it. And with that, we find a new way of life. We find a new way to go about life. And it is. It's been beyond my wildest dreams, and I'm just so full of gratitude for it. I'm full of gratitude for each and every one of you being here, instead of being out there right now. So thank you, and I'll leave it there.